Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
For decades, the historian Stephanie Kuntz has been asking people to reconsider what they think they know about marriage. And there's a clue to her approach in the title of one of her best-known books, The Way We Never Were. Again and again, Kuntz has argued, our assumptions about the past are often wrong, or at least they're incomplete. We imagine a time when families were more stable, when men and women knew their roles, when marriage was simpler. But she says it's not how it worked. And in her new book, Kuntz is at it again. This time she's trying to explain how it is that marriage rates have fallen dramatically over the past half century, but people are still getting married and still talking about it as deeply important. And to understand it, Kuntz says you have to look at how marriage has changed over time, not just ideas about love and sex and freedom, but how economic insecurity and growing inequality have changed what people expect from it. And the book is full of stories that complicate what we think we know about the past. Here's one of them. A few years ago, Kuntz got a call from a reporter at the New York Times. She calls this story The Mystery of the Misses.
Like many young activists, I grew up in an era of the 1950s and 60s when people would call in and say, this is Mrs. John Doe. I always assumed this was a legacy of patriarchy. But the newspaper called me because they were going through old issues and finding that even people who were really famous on their own were identified as Mrs. Frank Sinatra. So they said, well, when did this start? To my surprise, originally, Mrs. did not describe a woman's marital aspect. It described a woman's social status. It was the exact equivalent of Mr. And those were only the elites. So to call a woman Mrs. in those days was to describe her as one of the very elite members of society, either with an aristocratic background or tremendous wealth. An unmarried woman who had wealth or who was a writer, who was famous, would be called Mrs. and then her own name. That was very interesting to me because it points to a real paradox in the difference between patriarchy and democracy. In patriarchy, the ideology was that, you know, some people are born to be slaves, some people are born to be servants, some people are born to work for other people, women are born to be subordinate to their husbands. Well, democracy came along and said, no, people should not have to defer to people with more aristocratic backgrounds or a lot more money, and we should treat people as equals. But then this huge contradiction occurred. Women remained subordinate to their husband and excluded from many political things. Democracy was this huge step forward in raising the idea of human rights. But to the extent that it didn't step all the way forward, it had to come up with new excuses for why women weren't given the same rights, why slaves continued to be slaves. And that became a sort of new idea of Mrs. as someone who was subsumed by her husband. You know, and as a young feminist, I thought that was an ideology of patriarchy, but it turned out to be an innovation of democracy. And that's the kind of interesting contradiction that I found when I really began to dive into the history of marriage and gender relations as they've changed over the last 300 years. There have been just dozens of different ideas of how marriage should work. They'd get integrated into children's stories, into preaching in the churches, into legal terms. And we get these passed down, sometimes totally contradictory ones. And in my book, I call them earworms, even as we have embarked upon very new types of marriages that need new types of relationships than in the past. In fact, we're trying to do something absolutely unprecedented with marriage. We are looking to build marriages that are not based on coercion. And the result is that we are looking for marriages that are really negotiated for the first time, that are really mutual. And all of these earworms about what we're supposed to do as men or as women or as marriage partners tend to get in the way. And of course, it's even more complicated by the fact that at the very time as marriage requires more time, gratitude, real mutual support, we're also facing a society in which work pressures and economic pressures and fears for our economic future are getting stronger. So it's easy to say maybe it was better in the past, but I can pretty much guarantee you that when a marriage works today, it works better than people of the past would ever dream. It just takes more work and more commitment.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, Stephanie Kuntz will try and explain why marriage has become more fulfilling for many people and yet more uncertain than ever. Her book is called For Better and Worse. Kuntz is the director of research and public education for the Council on Contemporary Families. And she told us the book began as her way of trying to understand the complaint she kept hearing. Americans no longer value marriage.
Now, we'd heard that before in the 1980s, and my first popular book was called The Way We Never Were, Nice. Marriage and the Nostalgia Trap. So I started out this book thinking, well, I should really knock down that nostalgia trap again. But this time, as I listened to what people were complaining about and what they thought they lost, I began to think to myself, I've been too hard on this question. I need to understand, even though I know that they're wrong to think that we would be happier going back to the marriages of the 1950s, I need to dig a little deeper and find out what are the really legitimate anxieties and concerns that lead them to start looking back to the 1950s. And once I began to explore that, I began to look at it in a slightly different way.
One of the things the book is not about, you mentioned this early on, is why marriage is irrelevant or obsolete. People do still find it relevant. And I wanted to ask you about that. People are still getting married. Go through some of the numbers as you understand them. I think one thing that stood out to me is this poll taken in 2024 by the Pew Research Center that found only 8% of unmarried adults between 18 and 34 said they didn't want to marry, like only 8%. But 23% said they weren't sure. And it's that lack of being sure that I wanted to ask you about. So what are you seeing in those numbers?
Well, I think that it is exactly what we're seeing is how much more people expect to get for marriage and to give to marriage than the past, and how much more work that takes and wonder about whether they can do it. The same poll that showed how people were getting less certain that they would marry, even if they said that they wanted to. And this is a poll that's been going on a long, long time. They asked graduating seniors, how good a partner do you think you will be? And for years, they were pretty cocky about it. They'd say, we'd be a very good partner. But the last 10 or 15 years, they've been very hesitant to say that they would be a very good partner. And I think that's a good piece of evidence that it's not that they are devaluing marriage. It's that they have higher standards for what it takes to be a good partner. And they understand that that is a very difficult thing. They need to be very mature themselves. They need to make very sure that the partner they marry is mature. And they also have to have enough economic or work stability so that they won't be constantly under stress and unable to keep up the kinds of constant mutual reinforcement that an egalitarian marriage requires today.
You say that one of the reasons you wrote the book was to just to sort of see how these rewards and risks of marriage are changing. Let's just talk broadly about what you've noticed. Let's start with the rewards and just the sense of how that's changed. And I guess we can fold in the risks anytime you want. But like, what are the biggest, I guess, structural changes that distinguish modern marriage from earlier marriages? How, you know, has marriage become more emotionally demanding? Like, how do you explain the risks and rewards that have changed?
Well, of course, not everybody gets them equally in equal shares. But when a marriage works today, there are some things that are highly predictive of it working and getting better. And that is an egalitarian division of labor around the home, and especially in child rearing. And when you talk about rewards, maybe I'll just skip right ahead to what it means to share child raising. It's, first of all, it really rewards the marriage. Researchers find that no matter how much people love each other at the beginning of a marriage, if they don't develop some good sharing of child rearing and housework, but child rearing is particularly good, that love tends to taper off. Whereas couples that do, their love continues to grow over time. But the one that really strikes me as extremely important is what it does for men. When men start getting involved in caring, it turns out that it changes their brains in ways that are somewhat similar to the changes that go on in a mother's brain. They get more oxytocin, the hormone that breeds love. They get more patient. They get more concerned. The brain rewires itself in a way. Actually, it looks as though the brain circuits are narrowing, but they're actually focusing so that they can pay more attention to what's happening to the children. And it leads to all sorts of incredible outpourings of good emotions and good feelings and good ability to relate to the child and to the other partner. One of the most important benefits for fathers and for mothers is that the kids grow up more attuned to both parents. So these are all good things, I think.
You mentioned the work of a sociologist here at the University of Utah, Daniel Carlson, who was wondering if there were differences in the way, you know, different couples defined and sort of implemented equality in the home. And you report that when he was doing this work, he found that couples who operated on a, you know, a, as he put it, a separate but equal as opposed to mutually shared routine, they were the least happy. So this directly relates to marital satisfaction, the sense of sharing things equally.
Yes, this study is particularly interesting. Now, I have to say that there are always exceptions to these things. My husband and I do have a mother specialized division of labor, but it's not along the traditional male-female lines, and we negotiated it ourselves and are happy with it. But what Dan found that was really interesting, you looked at couples who described themselves as doing equal amounts of work around the house. You know, they really felt it was egalitarian. And he found that not all of these couples were satisfied with their marriage. So does that mean that egalitarianism doesn't work? So, well, he said to himself, well, maybe there's some difference in the way they are defining and organizing egalitarianism. And what he found out was that couples who either jointly did most of the routine tasks that used to be associated with women, laundry, cooking, cleaning, shopping, sweeping, that sort of thing, that the ones who either did them together or alternated those tasks were the ones who were the most happy with their marriage and their division of labor. The ones who said that they did equal amounts but never did the same ones, those were the least happy. So why would that be? I think it's because, first of all, if you haven't done a chore yourself, you don't really know how much it takes, but you know how much your own chore takes. So you think, well, sweeping the floor is easy. You don't think about the kid running across and having to do it over and over again. And the wife can think about the man. Well, what he's doing, oh, that's easy. Who could not do that? So to the extent that these couples have actually experience the chores, they know how much touch-up work, how many mistakes can go wrong, how many times you have to do it back. They're much more likely to really feel that everybody's doing their fair share.
Let me read something that you write in the book. In his dissent to the Supreme Court ruling legalizing same-sex marriage, Chief Justice John Roberts claimed that, and here you're quoting him, he claimed that for thousands of years of human history, in every society known to have populated the planet, the word marriage referred to only one relationship, the union of a man and a woman. Give us a sense of that kind of thinking, first of all. The idea that there was one established idea. Set aside the same-sex marriage part for a moment, and just the general idea that the Chief Justice there was trying to sort of mention, that there was one stable institution here at play. Talk a little bit about that kind of thinking.
Well, I generally try to be gentle when I criticize someone, but this statement is completely ignorant of how history works. There have been so many times of different kinds of marriages. The kind of marriage cited most in the first five books of the Bible is one man, many women. We know of at least 50 societies where a woman could marry more than one man, and often did. There are a few societies, not many, that actually don't have marriage at all, where a woman has a child by a visiting lover, and the family, her sisters and brothers, help raise that child. But marriage is pretty universal. Its form is extremely variable.
Stephanie Kuntz. Her new book is called For Better and Worse, The Complicated Past and Challenging Future of Marriage. We'll take a break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. We're talking with Stephanie Kuntz today. She's an historian of marriage and family. And Kuntz says marriage used to mean something quite different than it does today. Go back, way back to early prehistoric partnerships. Marriage was a system of economic cooperation and social obligation. Today, we think of it as a relationship of love and personal fulfillment. And the shift has uncovered this kind of weird paradox. She says, we're asking more of marriage than ever, but we're also feeling less certain it can hold up. Kuntz is asking how modern insecurities are clashing with the legacy of marriage's complicated past. Her book is called For Better and Worse. I want to back up to these foraging societies in the Stone Age to give us a sense of what that teaches us about how what marriages were like. It's one of these systems that you explore. And you say in the book that marriage, I guess if we can call it that, played a very different role than it did in a patriarchal, class stratified, you know, system. How did marriage work in that part of our human history?
Well, I think that most people have studied it agree that marriage was very important, but for very different reasons. The first reason it was not important, but what many people believe, was that marriage was invented to give every wife and child someone who would provide for them, go out and hunt for them. Yeah. But that's not the way band-level societies work. Women usually gather or hunt small animals and provide about half the calories in such societies. And when there are big game hunts, women are less likely to go on big hunts that last for several days and where you have to run after someone. You know, you don't want to drop your nursing baby to do that. So those tend to be males, and sometimes accompanied by a few younger women who want to participate. When they bring home the game, it's not distributed to the person or people who killed it. Everyone in the whole camp gets a call on that game. And researchers who've looked at this found that a child who is father is a bad hunter or who doesn't have a father around is no more malnourished than anybody else, as gets just the same amount of calories. So marriage plays a different role there. It does allow for a division of labor between husband and wife so that she may be gathering or killing small animals or collecting clams if they're by the ocean while if he was out on a hunt. But it also allows, and very importantly, it's the way of building friendships.
Yeah.
Elders get involved in choosing who will marry. Unlike later societies, it's very easy for women and men to part, and there's no concept of illegitimacy. A child has a claim on the group's food, whether they've been part of a marriage or not.
So these marriages were, as you say, circulating resources and people, creating these social networks that united people and reunited different groups. But then you say, after millennia of this kind of life, this egalitarian sort of structure, inequality starts to develop in places. Take us through that. What happens? Why does that? That seems good. So what happened?
Well, we don't know all of the processes, and I certainly wouldn't dare give you one particular answer for that.
Yeah.
But as people developed property that could be stored, you can see a situation where bands from other groups that might not have it or might be hungry might want more than you can just share with relatives or as a friendly gesture. So you get more involved in guarding your resources. And as you guard the resources, there is one pretty big difference between men and women, and that is that especially before the invention of birth control and Tampax and feeding bottles, men are more mobile and they tend to be a little stronger than women. So if you're going to try to defend your possessions or your territory, you tend to concentrate men. And as that develops, you begin to get not only differences within, between groups, in terms of who has more wealth and access to resources, but you also tend to get differences within the group. So that suddenly it's not, as a parent, I want my child to marry someone. I no longer am pretty indifferent as to who she chooses from a group of people who might provide helpful resources. I want her or him to marry someone with equal resources or preferably more.
Yeah.
And this is where marriage begins to develop into a strategy and a way of getting inequality. And you get maneuvering to who should move with marry who. And by the time you get full states, marriage is a real important tool of diplomacy and even of war, of gaining military alliances. So you begin to see these differences develop and marriage becomes more private. The big thing is that it used to be that people married out, married exogamously. They married people they weren't already related to. But then you get for a long time marrying endogamously. We want to marry people we are related to, people who can help us hoard and expand the new kind of private wealth we have. And that also means we want more control over the women of our group so that they don't choose mates that we don't approve of or bear children who are related to groups that we don't want to have alliances and close obligations to. And that's where you get the invention of illegitimacy. As they put it in feudal England, filius nullius, a child of no one, entitled to nothing from anyone. That is a concept totally foreign to band-level societies.
Well, you mentioned the work of the anthropologist Sarah Hardy, and this was striking. You mentioned she points out that women, as this now is evolving away from this egalitarian concept, that women were increasingly obliged to marry men who could provide, you know, economic resources, and they were, this is a quote from her, less able to prioritize criteria like generosity and tolerance and good sense in choosing a marriage partner. That seems incredible, I think. Really important.
Absolutely really important because, you know, left to themselves, women are not going to choose a big bully.
Yeah.
Even if he does bring home a little more meat than somebody else. So the fact is that as the elders of the group begin to say, you know, we need to make sure that the women marry only these kind of people. These are the kind of people who are not going to spend much time with kids anyway because they're going to be going out for warring or getting wealth or trading. So as Sarah put it very beautifully, women get attached to babies and men that they might not have wanted to be attached to originally, and men lose their access to babies. And given what we talked about earlier about how being attached to babies changes a man's personality even, that's a bad development in history.
So as we're moving sort of throughout this history, we get to the Bronze Age. And by this time, you mentioned these dominant clans had developed, you know, these aristocracies that were based on, you know, hereditary lineages and things like that. And then we get to, you described the fall of the Roman Empire, and the sort of the Christian church now becomes a major power. What influence does the church have on, is it starting to have now on this institution, this idea of marriage?
Well, the church departs quite a bit from Jesus's originally, from the New Testament and the early approaches of the church, because if we look carefully at what Jesus said about family values, in some ways they're more like those of the early egalitarian societies that everyone is, everyone I'm related to, that you should share with everyone, that that's the important thing, that that if you have to leave your father's funeral to help go build the Christian community, you should do so. And at the very end of when Jesus is on the cross, I've always been struck by this, he notices Mary standing beside some of her relatives, and he doesn't then say, well, you go with them, they'll take care of you. He chooses a non-biologically related disciple, and he says, here, this will be your son. And he says to the disciple, this will be your mother. Kind of like some of the effective kinship that we see in band-level societies. So it's interesting that as the church developed and became part of the power structure, it actually made some of the same changes toward more rigid marriage routines and more rigid ideas about legitimacy. And what is particularly interesting is that the early church, really up until the 12th century, wasn't as involved in thinking that marriage was the highest relationship and the highest way of virtue than that it could be. In fact, you would be horrified by some of the things that the early Christian leaders said about marriage and about women who were wives and had and enjoyed sex. You know, you had St. Jerome, for example, advised women whose husband had died to not get married again. He said that would be like a dog returning to its vomit. Because you'd have to have sex, which he thought was bad. So there are all these myths about early Christianity. But as Christianity became very important as a as an official religion, then it could play a very interesting role in the power struggles, because there would be all these competing aristocratic groups or kings that so they would go to the church to try to get them to support their idea of what was a just war or of what was a good marriage and who should be allowed to divorce and remarry if they didn't have an heir. And so each of those groups would lobby with the church, and they would be happy to, if a rival got something that they didn't like, a decision that, oh, yeah, you can marry, you can remarry now, you don't have a child, you can remarry this woman, and they didn't approve of that, they would go to a different body of the church and try to get a different answer from them, and they would enforce whatever answer from whatever body of the church that they agreed with. So it was a lot of chaos there for a while.
One of the periods you work through also is this sort of the paradox of patriarchy, the emergence of the idea of patriarchy, or how we've gotten the ideas of patriarchy wrong, or at least the history of it. That's one of the things I think you've said you had to rethink. Talk a little bit about what you thought, how you thought the patriarchy was working and how it actually seemed to work, because there's a lot of class distinctions here, not just male-female things. That surprised me in the story.
Well, I think I had changed my mind about patriarchy a little bit before I wrote this book, but it became so much more clear to me that patriarchy was a system of class and rank that way outweighed gender, even though any person, any woman who was married to a man of equal rank, they had to be subordinate. And the rule of the men over women who were subordinate to them could be extremely brutal. On the other hand, there are aspects of patriarchy that worked against this. For example, among the commoners, most families were literally dual provider families. Mm. No man referred to his wife as his sweetheart or his dependent. He called her his helpmate or his meat help, his yoke mate, because they both were involved in small farms and in trading. And even if the man was in charge, the woman was not normally seen as a deputy husband. And she was expected to behave in very assertive ways as long as this was to carry out the family behavior. So in other words, She was subordinate to the husband, but she had a lot of referred authority that she could utilize over other people. And that was even more true in the upper classes, that the upper class women who were part of the informal networks that decided who were going to be kings and queens, they had a lot of power in arranging marriages and alliances. So there are these interesting trade-offs. I wouldn't want to go back to patriarchy or anything, but it's interesting that in today's society, women in corporations who have higher authority are more likely to experience sexual harassment from men than lower class ones. Whereas, of course, this just would not have been thinkable in the patriarchal era.
Let's talk about when the idea of love comes into the picture or how it develops. One of the things you mentioned in the book is that over the last few decades, that when you look at polls, between 60% and 75% of Americans tell pollsters they believe in soulmates, that there's one person out there that they're, you know, meant to be with. And I wonder, what do you make of that? And when does the idea of falling in love become an important dimension, as opposed to it just being an economic arrangement or a pragmatic kind of arrangement? How does love fit in the story?
Well, people have always fallen in love, and they've also often wanted to be with someone that they loved. But the realities of life made that more difficult. You know, you had to, if you were in the lower classes, you had to marry somebody who was accepted by your community and who you knew would make a good partner in whatever enterprise you were doing. You know, bakers tended to marry other bakers, for example, because after all, they already knew the trade. They wouldn't have to be taught.
Yeah.
If you were in the upper class, of course, you wanted to marry someone who had good connections and whose career you could help and whose you could help with a career. So for a long time, love was thought of as a luxury or a wonderful transcendent experience that basically had to end in tragedy because it couldn't last in the real world. And that's the first definition of soulmate,
yeah,
was this idea that you just looked at someone in their eyes, you fell in love with them, and you tried to cross whatever barriers there were and get rid of all the people who told you you couldn't get married and live together. But most of those stories ended in tragedy, with one dying or both of them committing suicide because they weren't allowed to marry. Mm. Later on, we get a different definition of soulmate, and it goes through a lot of different changes. In the middle classes of America and England, as we got more and more separation of men's role in the economy and women's role in the home, and to do men justice, they weren't just holding them in the home because they, you know, thought that they weren't worth anything. Men were bothered by the new commercial economy and all of the calculation that had to go on. And they began to idealize women as being different from that, as being the people who could provide soul in one's life, that you would come home to, that they would get you away from all of the business compromises you'd had to make, and they would remind you of the higher things in life. It didn't always work that way, but there was that idealization of soulmate. By the time you get to people calling themselves soulmates today, I think most of them mean good friends and good sex.
Yeah.
But some of them have hung on to this idea that we were meant to be, that there's nobody else. And family researchers on both sides of the political spectrum, we all agree that that is a very dangerous way of looking at love, because it has the idea that if you were meant to be, then if something goes wrong, you must not be meant to be. And it doesn't lead you into the kind of negotiation and working on the relationship that is actually needed to make a modern relationship last.
Stephanie Kuntz, her book is For Better and Worse, The Complicated Past and Challenging Future of Marriage. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for Radio West comes from our members. Sustain us at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with the historian Stephanie Kuntz. We're talking about her book about the complicated past and challenging future of marriage. It's called For Better and Worse. Let me jump forward a bit. So if most Americans are still getting married, if domestic violence rates are lower than in the past, if there's less child abuse than in the past, if divorce rates are actually falling, what's the problem?
Well, the good news is, as you say, that domestic violence is decreasing, that people are really doing marriage. When they're doing it right, they're doing it better, perhaps, than ever before in history. And I think most people are surprised to learn that divorce rates have fallen now. They've been falling since 1970s and now as low as the 1950s. Mm. But there is a catch.
Yeah.
And that is that there's a tremendous change in who gets married, and fewer people are getting married. The people who are getting married are the ones who have this ideal of marriage as a real close relationship and who have the economic and emotional maturity to do it. This is what's wrong with this idea that we're going to solve fertility and solve marriage problems by trying to get people to marry earlier before. Every year a woman postpones marriage into her mid-30s, her chance of divorce tends to fall, precisely because of what these people recognize around them, even if they don't know the research, that marriage today, because of the joint responsibilities and goals, takes more maturity, it takes more security to be able to do these things. And so people tend to wait to marry until they feel that they have proven themselves. They've got a job that has decent hours, that has some future in it. They have found a partner that they think can be counted on, that they know themselves that they can be counted on. And the result is that we're seeing a washout of a lot of couples before marriage. Today, cohabitation is the way that most people start a marriage. The majority of people who marry have cohabited first, but the majority of people who cohabit don't go on to marry. And sometimes that is because they haven't met their bar for what are the economic and the emotional aims and they think prerequisites for marriage. And along the way, they have run into the kind of troubles that are associated with economic insecurity or change, and they break up because they are having these problems that they hope to avoid.
Society, you say, is facing this new reality that people are less inclined to enter the institution just for practical advantages. Now they want different things from marriage than they used to. They're engaged in, as you say, more protracted comparison shopping. What are the different things they want, do you think?
Well, exactly. People now see marriage more as a relationship than an institution.
Right.
It's the marriage relationship they value. And the institution, if it doesn't provide that relationship, they are more prepared to either not enter or to get out of if it goes wrong. People are no longer prepared to put up with the kinds of things that you read about. If you look about 1950s diaries or interviews with women, over and over again, they'll say things like, but you know, he doesn't hit me. He very seldom gets drunk. And that's a lot more than my mother had. And she didn't complain. So what right do I have to complain? Well, you know, you and I and most modern women would think there were some real things to complain about.
Yeah.
But this was the idea. When you didn't have much of a choice outside marriage, particularly for women, you put up with stuff that you wouldn't put up with today. So the problem today is that we really have these new standards and these new ideals. Most people want really intensely friendly mutual relationships, and yet they are going into situations that are just constantly adding stress about whether they'll be able to afford a home. All the things that we need for future security, those are the ones that have been most hit by inflation. You know, mass ready-made clothing, computers, televisions, those are cheaper and cheaper and cheaper, and that brings down the average. But childcare, medical insurance, homes, all of these things that are essential to feeling confident in your family's future, these are getting much harder to reach. And the result is that many people think that without being reaching them, that they're just going to have so many conflicts and so many stresses that they won't be able to maintain the kind of marriages they want.
The other thing that's striking, if we go back to, we were talking earlier about the way marriages worked earlier in these Stone Age societies, in this prehistoric era. And marriages, it wasn't an individualistic thing. It was for, you know, sharing resources, distributing them fairly. It was for creating these social networks, these larger anyway, social networks. And one of the things you talk about is where we are now, and I'm sure this is obvious to people. Marriage, you say, tends to shrink people's social networks these days rather than expand them the way they used to. And I wonder what you make of that and what that might mean.
Well, I think that's in part a heritage of this 1950s nuclear family kind of idealization as people were moving out to the suburbs. And I think it's a very unfortunate heritage because the fact is that marriages are happier when people have outside friends and companions. When a woman or a man has a friend that they can turn to and talk through things independently from the spouse, it turns out not only are they happier, but their spouse is happier, even though the spouse has not been involved in that. Because we are social animals. We need social feedback. I'm fond of saying that date night, once you've been going out for a while, date night's probably the worst advice you can give yourself to keep your marriage vibrant and vital. And in fact, they've done studies of sending people out on date nights versus sending them out with new people that they get to know. And they find that the people come home from those outings feeling much more sexual attraction and much more emotional attraction to each other. And if I may just be personal, I can see that in my own marriage, you know. My husband has a wonderful sense of humor. He is full of funny stories, but I've heard them all. when we go out with people, though, and he gets a chance to say them, I'm not bored with them when he says them then. I'm proud of him. I encourage him. I say, tell him about the time, because he is so funny. People love that. And I get the reflected glory from it, and it sends us both home, he with the ego and me with the reflected glory of his it, that stuff. That's what couples and hanging out with other people can do for you. And also just having other people that bring you new information. It doesn't even have to be close friends. I told my husband a few months ago about the research that I was put in my book about how just consequential strangers, they're called, just interactions with someone you're never going to get to know, but that you just have a pleasant interaction with all the time. I was telling him how much a difference that meant to people's morale and actually to their relationships with more significant others. And bless his heart, he started doing that, and he came home a few months later. He said, I've started talking to people in lines and in waiting rooms. I put down the phone and I talk to people, and you're absolutely right. I feel better about it, and I've obviously made their day better. And that makes our marriage better.
Wow. Well, you write about how when you and your husband got married, that your wedding vows included this promise to your friends and your families that just because you were getting married, they weren't going to lose their relationship with you. And I wanted you to sort of talk a little bit about that, because when your son and daughter-in-law got married, you said they didn't ask for the bride's father to give her away. They each gave their own parents away to the other parents. Again, that social network broadened it. Will you talk about that?
You can still tear me up when you remind me of it. It was a lovely thing. But I don't want to exaggerate it. We have times that we want to be on our own and private. But one of the things that we noticed from research and from personal experience is that when people couple up, they tend to distance themselves from friends that were supportive in the past. And turns out studies show that married couples provide less support to coworkers and extended family members and spend less time talking with older friends. And the result is that you can get fixated on your own relationship in ways that doesn't renew it. So we made a big point when we got married of where this isn't just a combination of us two, and we want you to respect our relationship, although we do want you to respect our relationship. It's an invitation to our two sets of friends to get to know each other and to get to know us and to do some mingling together. And I think that there's a lot of research that shows that those kinds of commitments, in addition to the romantic one, actually nurture the romantic one as well as nurturing a broader sense of community.
Let me ask you finally, one of the things you reveal in the book is how a lot of the problems in marriages aren't because of personal flaws, but that there's something larger that you want people to keep in mind. That these are things that we've inherited from the past, these social norms and these conditioned reflexes and other things. Would you finally say something about that? Explain why you think that's important for people to understand this.
Yes, I think it's very important. You know, when I was younger, I was sometimes accused of being overly intellectual. But I think that knowing the history and sociology is the equivalent of what therapists call looking for the soft emotion under the hard emotion when you've got a problem with somebody else. So that when my husband does something that hurts me or annoys me, it's a little one, but he grew up in New York. So he's likely to say things like, "What, are you crazy?" Now, I grew up in, you know, a small town. I came home every year to Tumwater, which was a smaller town than Olympia. You know, when we disagree with something, we say, "Well, that's a really good point, but have you ever thought of this?" So when he would do that hard stuff, I was initially just outraged. But when I learned, you know, about how New York works and he explained it to me, now I can say, okay, this doesn't bother me so much. That's a very simple explanation. But when you look at some of the most common conflicts between couples today, it can really help to do it. Men, for example, have this idea that they're not very good at doing these little things around the house. They've been told to ignore it for years, to concentrate on more important things. So initially when they say, "I'll do it," and then it doesn't get done, it's very easy to interpret that as a very personal slight. But instead, if you can say, "Look, I know why you think you can't do this, but you know, men were doing this for thousands of years, and I bet you you're man enough to learn how to do it yourself now. Let's talk about how to do that." That's a little more inviting way to take on the problem that is annoying you. You don't just say, "Okay, I know why you're doing it," and I'll let it go. But you say, "I know why you're doing it. I'm not taking it personally, but eventually it will start wearing on me, and so let's see what we can do to change it." And we women have to recognize it. I've talked about these things for years, and yet I'll fall into some of the traps. One of them is what we call gatekeeping, where the woman has been told, you know, for 150 years, not under patriarchy, but under democracy, we were told we were the ones who understood the workings of the household and the emotions and how to deal with children, and men weren't good at that. And so we do this thing called gatekeeping, where we say we want their help, but we want them to do it on our terms and subject to our corrections. And I explain in the book two incidents where, despite all the talks I give telling women not to do this, I did it to my husband. One was where he caught me reloading the dishwasher after he'd loaded. You know, he said to me, why are you doing that? You know, it will get washed perfectly well. And it was like, okay, sorry. And I can see where it feels a little insulting to you. So for months after that, he didn't load the dishwasher after his lunch. And I had to say, "Well, okay, well, that was a hard lesson, but I deserved it." Even after that, though, the very first time that our grandchild came to visit, very young baby, I was in the kitchen cooking, And he was out with, the baby was out with grandpa, and the baby started to wail. I dropped what I was doing, swooped in, grabbed the baby out of his arms. Well, he was mad at me. He was, he was very mad at me. But again, because he had heard me explain what gatekeeping was, and I could say to him, oh my God, that habit just kicked in. I'm really sorry. He could get over his anger a lot faster. So that's why I think that knowing history and sociology can actually help just as much as looking at some of the therapeutic rules that we're being told.
Stephanie Kuntz, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Stephanie Kuntz. She's the director of research and public education for the Council on Contemporary Families. She's also a professor emeritus at the Evergreen State College. Her new book is For Better and Worse, The Complicated Past and Challenging Future of Marriage. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We're on Instagram at Radio West. We're on YouTube at KUER90.1. You can email us at radiowest@kuer.org. Our intern is Aidan Oneida, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. I'm Doug Fabrizio.